This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Let's talk tonight about artificial intelligence. And I have, you know, an expert, one of the experts on to talk to me about it. But the reason I wanted to do this, the reason me, producer Matt, producer John wanted to do this show is we recently had a meeting in New York. It was about something separate, but a friend of ours, very knowledgeable friend, just had a big meeting with all these tech types. And the horror stories that came out about AI, about what it's going to do, what it's already doing. It's going to take all of our jobs. It's going to run our lives. It'll be reading your emails. We sat down and we watched him do this. We watched him typed a couple things into a computer, and then boom, he holds up his computer and a podcast comes on that was about the subject we put in there. All AI, a man and a woman, all artificial, talking to each other, even with little things like in their sentences, and we were all just floored. A podcast was just created by AI. That's where it already is. And you know what I felt like in that moment? You know what I felt like? Remember this old video of Regis Philbin when he saw the first iPhone?
Do you know what that big announcement is today with the iPod? Do you?
No, what?
Does anybody know what that is?
What is it? What
are we talking? I don't know. They're speculating an iPhone that you're going to be able to talk on the phone with your iPod.
You know what?
Tell us why it's a bad idea. Work, it's like the computer. It'll never take off.
What are you going to do? Carry the phone? You carry the phone over here. Carry the iPod over there. Carry the
device.
Thing between
it's
your
one
legs.
Thing.
Stop it.
One device.
It's the
it's
one
ridiculous.
Thing.
So many things to carry.
That's the idea. It's one device. It's an iPod and a phone.
No, I don't like it.
It's funny. But it's where I am with so much technology and definitely AI. Not interested. Don't want it. Give me a good old-fashioned book, a movie made by persons, personal interaction. But I can play the crotchety old man all I want. It is here, and it's coming, and I don't know where it's going to lead all of humanity. And that it will be one of these things that affects all of humanity. I don't know where it's going to go. We're going to talk to Joe Allen about that in a moment. I don't know. You don't know. But the technology itself sounds frightening, wonderful, amazing, sad, all of these things. If it cures cancer, that sounds great. If it takes away every human's job and we're sitting at home like a bunch of brain-dead slobs hooked up to a robot, probably not great. So when I talk to Joe Allen next, there's going to be parts of this that are scary, I promise you. There will be parts of it that are hopeful. We're going to find out what this is, where we are now, where we might be going, because no matter what, I don't care whether you're 95 or 5 watching me right now, AI is going to have some effect on your life. We should try to understand it. I'm going to try the same way you're going to try. Let's talk to Joe Allen about it next. You know, I got an email from a woman. She was in her 60s. And she was a tour guide. So she guides people around an area. And she said, Jesse, I used to have to take a nap. You know, she'd have to give people on a tour and then stop and take a nap because she's just out of gas. And she said, Jesse, since I started taking my female vitality stack from Chalk, I don't nap anymore. I go all day and I'm ready to keep going. Her energy was, she just sounded so happy. That's what natural herbal supplements can bring to you. Male vitality stacks and female vitality stacks. You don't have to be out of gas all the time, in a bad mood, feeling down all the time. You can actually get home at the end of the day and want to do something just because you feel good. 60, 90 days, that's how far you are away from feeling so much better. Go get a subscription, chalk.com/JesseTV. Okay, so that's my thoughts, good and bad, on AI. But as I said, I don't know anything about it. I'm old. I can't operate 90% of the functions on my phone, and I don't want to, but I do know enough to know it's going to be big. But Joe does know. We're joining me now, Joe Allen, author of the wonderful book, Dark Eon. All right, Joe, I'm going to ask you to do something that may be difficult for you, but I certainly need it, and I'm sure others do. I need you to take me as basic as you can, and then we'll build up to where we're at and where we're going. Artificial intelligence, on the most basic level, how does it work?
Well, Jesse, I appreciate you having me on, and you know, I myself am doing my best to wrap my head around this as it comes down the pipes. So hopefully I can give you the bare bones. In short, artificial intelligence is software that thinks, in scare quotes, thinks sort of like a human. People argue all the time, why call it artificial intelligence if it's not truly intelligent like a human? It's a good point, but the reality is that systems like ChatGPT, in the beginning, it was, you could say, barely intelligent. It showed some indications that you could ask it a question and it would come back with something like a coherent response. This was in the early days, like 2017, 2018. By the time we get to 2020 and the company OpenAI had improved both the system itself, the software, and expanded the amount of data and the amount of computation to be thrown at it, it started doing really weird things. The weirdest thing that it did was take all of that data and begin to produce something like a human response. So that when we get to November of 2022 and the release of ChatGPT and all of the media attention and the discussion around it, the reason people were freaking out is because, unlike the previous chatbots, you know, just software that you're talking to, it talks back to you, the previous chatbots, by and large, had these canned responses. So you say, how are you today? And, you know, with some options, it's going to say, I am doing very well. This is very kind of you to ask. It would be very stiff. The newer systems have trained on basically all available human text on the internet, in books, and now more and more, they're being trained on conversations people have had with AI. Hundreds of millions of conversations. And with all of that information, and with all of the compute that goes into these data centers that are popping up everywhere, and with this huge virtual brain, which is the software itself, it's, in essence, if you could imagine a massive computer system with a virtual brain inside of it, chewing on all this data. In the new systems, it not only produces a coherent response, it can solve math problems at a PhD level. It can formulate actionable scientific experiments. This is happening right now in labs across the world. It can give you responses on any high-level academic question that you have at a PhD level. Now, you'll hear people say all the time, I'm sure you've seen this, if AI is so smart, why can't it count the number of fingers on a hand? Or why is it producing six-fingered hands? If it's so smart, why can't it count the number of R's in the word strawberry? And these are good points. It is oftentimes hallucinating, as they say, meaning that it just makes things up. And it makes things up and says it authoritatively. But the way I like to think of it, because I do consider this to be an active war against the human race itself. I know that sounds dramatic. I can explain in detail. But when you're in a war, you obviously want to pay attention to the misses in incoming fire, but you really want to pay attention to the hits. And so every time a chatbot says something really ridiculous, it makes up an entirely fictitious biography of Jesse Kelly when you ask who Jesse Kelly is. Consider that a miss. But when you ask it who Jesse Kelly is, and it goes through and tells you every detail of your life that you've at least put on the internet, and does so correctly, then you consider that a hit. And the hits keep coming at greater and greater frequency and greater accuracy. So again, AI is a virtual brain that thinks, again in scare quotes, thinks something like a human being.
Okay, I have about 8,000 questions to ask off of that. I swear I won't ask 8,000 though, but who is creating this artificial brain? Who is the person, persons, entities, nation states? Who is creating this and why? Let's start there.
Well, the why, is that really gets spicy. But I'll take you through a really, really short history. 1956, the word artificial intelligence is coined at a conference at Dartmouth, and it was coined by a guy, John McCarthy. Artificial intelligence at that time was defined as a machine that could think like a human. So we're talking everything a human can do, a machine that can do it. At that time, obviously, it was just a dream. It's a whole lot of diagrams on paper. Fast forward to the 60s, and you have the chatbot Eliza. And it was just a very simple chatbot, but the thing that was really intriguing is that people loved talking to it. And it basically stayed at the Eliza level for decades. I mean, it got better, but it's just canned responses. The real race that we're in right now for artificial intelligence, you could say, began in the late aughts, early teens of the 2000s. And Google is working as hard as they can on their chatbots and other AI systems. And they're pushing towards something called artificial general intelligence, meaning instead of just being able to process language or sequence genomes or simulate a mechanical system, it has general intelligence. It can do all those things and more. You could say that artificial general intelligence just gets back to the original definition. It's a goal to create a virtual brain that is on par with a human being. We'll peg this to the early teens of the 2000s, and Google is racing ahead, and it's noticed by people like Elon Musk and Sam Altman. And Elon Musk and Sam Altman in 2015, they found OpenAI in partnership with other high-level AI scientists. And their goal was to compete with Google, who they perceived as evil and totalizing. And so you now have two major players racing towards artificial general intelligence. And within OpenAI, you had people like Dario Amodei, who were not satisfied with the safety standards within the company. And so he spins off and forms Anthropic. And then Elon Musk famously grew frustrated with OpenAI, especially the fact that they were not open sourcing the AI, meaning putting everything out for the public to go over and for other AI experts to replicate. And so Musk founds xAI. Those are the four frontier AI companies: Google, OpenAI, Anthropic, and xAI. They have the most capable AI systems. They have the most compute, meaning they have the most data centers and the most GPUs or processing units inside those data centers. And they have, like many people at this point, almost all available human data to chew this stuff up. So those four companies are at the forefront of AI advancement. And then you have imitators in China So your listeners may have heard of DeepSeek, for instance, which was created by a firm called HiFlyer. You also have systems coming out under Alibaba. And you also have companies like Huawei that are creating data centers. So you have all these Chinese counterparts. And the Chinese are definitely behind the U.S. But for reasons we can go into or not, they are catching up. One reason I have to highlight that they're catching up is due to so many Chinese people in the companies themselves that are at the forefront feeding information back. And also because the U.S., due to kind of open borders or free trade policies, have transferred a lot of this technology to China. So you have all, so you have these four frontier companies, add Meta if you want, although they kind of stink at this point, and China. They're the ones making it. Now, why? Why is a different question altogether.
Well, why?
Depending on who you ask, they either want to create a human-level virtual brain so that human beings basically up their game. If you have a system that is as smart as any human at anything, it allows you to have, as Sam Altman says, a PhD in your pocket. So any question you have, you can ask this machine. It's sort of like Google, or it's sort of like if you know an expert in a field, except for this is a kind of universal expert that you can ask and trust any question on anything. Now, that's the kind of positive use case. There's a huge problem with that because it is conditioning people to turn to machines as the highest authority on what is and is not real, or for moral questions, what is and is not good, or personal questions, what is or is not pleasurable, beautiful. That's a huge problem in and of itself, but let's just say that's the positive case. The other case put forward by people at Google, by Elon Musk himself, by Dario Amodei at Anthropic, and by Sam Altman at OpenAI, is that they will create artificial general intelligence. Think of it as kind of true artificial intelligence, a machine that can think at the level of any human at anything. But it's de facto going to be better than any human at anything. It has more data. It never goes to sleep. It can talk to hundreds of millions of people simultaneously. And then the goal becomes replacement. So this is openly discussed. Elon Musk is probably the most open about it, but he's pursuing it anyway. It begins with the coders, ironically enough. I guess they get what they deserve. It begins with the coders, because if there's one thing AI excels at, it is writing functional code. Again, it screws up all the time. Fine, those are misses. But it hits very frequently, increasingly frequent. So the goal is ultimately replacement. You begin with coders and other IT specialists. You also then move into white collar work, so copywriters, lawyers, accountants, doctors, financial analysts, on and on and on. And then as robotics become more and more sophisticated, and they've lagged behind the AI. Nobody really expected that. They've lagged behind the AI, but humanoid robots and other robotic systems have undoubtedly accelerated in their sophistication, in their advancement, especially over the last 5 years. And a lot of that's due to AI. AI allows for the acceleration of robotics because it's able to simulate, because it's able to analyze. So the ultimate goal, you know, people talk about the great replacement, mass immigration replacing the native population. This is the greater replacement. This, if it were actually realized, and I think there's every reason to be skeptical that it's ever going to be 100% realized, but it's the goal. If it were ever realized, it would mean that we would live in a world in which all of the major decisions, all of the economically fruitful work, all of the intellectual questions are then handed over to machines. So what do? Well, you hear all of these guys at the Frontier Labs, the AI companies that I mentioned, Google, XAI, Anthropic, OpenAI, their executives and many within talk about radical abundance, meaning that we have everything we could possibly want that machines have produced for us, including longevity, because they've solved, they've created cures for cancer, they've solved aging, maybe we reverse our aging, all of that. But human beings have zero economic value at that point. So there is no leverage whatsoever, no negotiating power whatsoever. We are simply at the mercy of these companies and every apparatus around them. And we either become pets, or maybe we become entertainment for them. Maybe, you know, the more entertaining you are, the higher level you are. Or, worst case scenario, energy becomes a problem and they turn us into biofuel. But one way or the other, we are no longer in charge of our destiny. We're simply on a roller coaster ride that they call the singularity.
Okay, let me ask this question. You said you're skeptical it's going to get all the way there, and I think those of us who are a little bit apprehensive about where this might go liked hearing that. Why don't you explain why you're skeptical that it's going to get to the place where I'm biofuel?
Well, I can't make any promises for you, and I certainly am not holding out a whole lot of hope for me. We may be the first on the chopping block, but everybody, I think the primary reason I'm skeptical is that I've spent a lot of years poring over futurist visions, going all the way back to the 17th century. But especially from the early 20th century on, you know, science fiction and futurism are really developing. And by the late 20th century, early 21st, you have this whole array of very, very specific visions of how the future is going to end up. One of the most famous, of course, Ray Kurzweil. Going back before him, Arthur C. Clarke, who authored 2001 A Space Odyssey and many other very famous science fiction stories that turned out to be pretty accurate, but not 100% accurate, not even close really to 100% accurate. Directionally, they get a lot right, but on the specifics, they tend to get a lot wrong. Even Ray Kurzweil, who everybody says is 86% accurate, I've never seen the breakdown. And branch out to any other futurist. AI is going to create a utopia, or technology is going to create a utopia. Bases on the moon, space exploration, all these sorts of things. Or total doom, right? Nuclear annihilation, robots come alive and kill everybody, all these sorts of things. If you look at the specifics of any of these futurist schemas, there are parts they get right, astonishingly. But they never get it all right. And I think that I really work from a premise that human beings are extremely limited in their ability to understand what's happening now. So we're extremely limited in understanding what's going to happen in the future. And also, we're just limited in general. God did not create us as little g gods. And even if we are allowed to flex our muscles to an extent, so to speak, without getting too preachy or religious, I think that the story of the Tower of Babel is very instructive on this, in which you had the Babylonian king create a tower to reach the heavens, and it was struck down by God, and all the peoples of the world were separated, and we were put back in our place. However one conceives of the world, I think there's a lesson there, because human beings have been always have been ambitious, always have been greedy, always have been cruel and violent, and yet history has shown time and time again those regimes do fall. So in the case of these, some would call them transhumanists or posthumanists, singularitarians, the terminology doesn't really matter. In the case of all of these tech bros or these tech oligarchs who buy into the idea that they're going to create a machine that in essence becomes little g God or big G God, that it's doomed to fail just by default. Now, you might say, well, Joe, that's not very convincing. That sounds like a faith claim. It is. And that's the best I can give you because I don't know exactly what the future is. None of us do. But I do know that the history of people claiming they know exactly what the future is going to be or that claiming that they will create a specific future, that history is fraught with a lot of failure, thank goodness. And so I think this is the case too. Even just right now, the idea that you have a PhD in your pocket you can trust, you know, I talked about those misses, the hallucinations or the inaccuracies. Well, they're still coming all the time, so you can't trust it 100%. And there are a lot of worse scenarios too. I mean, I don't want to get lost in those details, but such as AI psychosis and children being urged to suicide by artificial intelligence, all of these unintended consequences are stacking up. And they're not really acknowledged by or infused into this grand vision of radical abundance and universal basic income. In fact, the tech companies have done everything they could to hide the effects of that and to dodge any responsibility on it. That being said, yeah, these are imperfect humans working on imperfect machines. And so the question I don't think is, will the machines take over? Or even will the tech oligarchs establish some kind of anti-Christ system across the entire planet? I think the question becomes, how do you respond to a situation in which the wealthiest men on Earth, who control far too much of the most powerful government on Earth, intend to create a digital deity and render you useless? And I don't think that it's a hopeless situation, but it's a situation that requires a clear-eyed assessment of where we are, and that is, in fact, where we are. It's not unlike being in the Roman Empire with Caesar demanding worship of his idol.
Joe, obviously, the question I'm about to ask is going to ask you to see the future in ways you can't possibly do, nobody can possibly do, but I'll ask it this way. So much of AI, so much of our thoughts on it, so much of what we hear about it is where it's going, right? And you just laid so much of that out for us, what it can do, where it's going. But if we're going to treat this like a 100-yard football field, if you will, where is it now? Is it on the one? Is it on the 50? Have they not even started playing the game yet? How much do you think is still to come?
You know... Right. That's the big question because, you know, the way they conceive of it is this singularity where the improvements go exponential and it just goes up and up and up and up until, again, you get digital God. But the history of technology goes in S-curves. The technology improves and then plateaus. Think of cars, for instance. You know, cars can go really fast now. But they can't go a whole lot faster than they could in the late 20th century, right? Little improvements get made, but it plateaus. So it's possible that we'll hit a plateau. I hope for a plateau. I hope for a solar flare. But barring that, where are we at right now? Well, I can tell you that in 2015, when OpenAI was founded, they weren't really all that far with language models. And, you know, in the gaming arena, they've come a long way. But anyway, from 2015 till now, 10 years, the improvements have been dramatic. So just to return to one theme, the ability of GPT-3 in 2020 or 2021 to solve math problems, to do high-level analysis of, say, a book, if you give it a book, tell me what it says, to have conversational English or any language, those sorts of things, it was there, but it was limited. Now, if you follow the evaluations, and if the audience is curious as to where they can find them, follow the evaluations of organizations like the Center for AI Safety, or follow the evaluations of organizations like Epoch AI, and look at how they test these systems to see how good they are at reading and writing, how good they are at math, how good they are at analyzing images. They are extraordinarily good given the expectation of the skeptic. They are able to, again, do PhD level math. They screw it up a lot, but the fact that they can do it at all is astonishing. It's not as if they were programmed to do those specific problems. They simply trained the model on vast amounts of data, and the model came to understand, in scare quotes, what was going on. So we're at a point now where AI can, in fact, perform human-level feats, superhuman-level feats, in very narrow domains. And it is becoming more and more general. So we're closer to artificial general intelligence than we were 10 years ago, absolutely. Where it goes from here, there are three factors that you have to look at as to where it goes from here. The first is where we let it go. Will there be a government or governments that say that there's a hard cap on how smart you can make these things? Because a lot of the people who work on these things are really concerned that it will get out of control. And so you put a hard cap on it. The second is just the limits to what's possible with the technology. Those limits have been pushed to extraordinary degrees at this point. So it's really difficult to tell where the wall is, so to speak. But assuming that it's not infinite and it's not going to go exponential, at some point you'll run into a hard limit. Maybe the AI can't get, maybe you can't get rid of the hallucinations entirely. Or maybe an AI really can't wrap its head around human emotions. I think those are things that are quite likely. And so that hard technological limit is the second. And the third is just resource. How many resources do we have to pour in it? You see the data centers going up everywhere. They literally use the same amount of electricity that you would pump into a vast city into a data center to train a single AI model like ChatGPT-5. If at some point, either it's taking away too many resources from humans and humans fight back, right? Or simply the resources aren't there ultimately to create this godlike AI, then you have that. So those are the three limiting factors. And I think that you might not be able to count on any one of them, certainly not all three, but I do think that they will come into play. Either human beings in power will say, no, enough is enough, or the system simply cannot get any better than a certain point, or you run out of resources. And there are other limiting factors too, but yeah, I think that, again, the big dreams, think about the big dreams of Nazism. I know this is kind of a cheap shot, but think about the big dreams of Nazism, of creating the perfect master race. Or think about the big dreams of communism to create the perfect socialist man. And they went, they poured vast amounts of resources and human capital into those projects. And they wrought untold amounts of horror and suffering on the world in that process. But they ultimately failed for many of the same reasons I just mentioned. And so, while I'm not necessarily trying to equate the tech oligarchs with Nazis and communists, I am at least drawing the parallel there. These are huge dreams that seem to be completely indifferent to the well-being of the people who are subject to those dreams. And I suspect that in the same way that Nazism failed, in the same way that communism failed, that the tech oligarchs will also fail. But they won't fail because people sat back and waited for somebody to fix it. I think that they'll fail because people have constantly stood up and pushed for their rights, whether it be on a personal level, on a communal level, on an institutional level, and more, you see it right now, it's all over the hill here, on a political level, that people will demand dignity, freedom, and their own humanity. I'm quite confident in that. And I will go kicking and screaming. There's no way I'm going to stop, so...
Joe, thank you for a half hour of your time and all that wisdom, brother. That was wonderful. Thank you so much. I feel so much smarter now. Better in some ways. Worse in other ways. Anyway, let's talk to a pastor. It'll make us feel better. Next. Next. It can be hard to get a good night's sleep in the Christmas season. And I know people usually get a day or two off. Maybe you got a week or more off coming up. But for some reason, the stresses keep piling up, don't they? There's always something to worry about. Did I wrap the gifts? Did I remember to send a card? I have a solution for you. And it's going to sound pretty common. How about a cup of hot chocolate at night? Only this is special hot chocolate. This is Dream Powder from Beam. You see, this hot chocolate has magnesium in it and reishi in it and melatonin in it. And essentially, this hot chocolate is going to have you drifting off to sleep. What I do when I want to make sure, when I have to have a good night's sleep, I have a little cup of hot chocolate. I warm up some milk in the nuker, a little scoop of Dream Powder, and I sleep like a baby every single time. And I don't wake up groggy and miserable. I wake up feeling good. Go to shopbeam.com/JesseKelly and get a bag.
Jesus was born out of a virgin mother. Mm. What's more virgin than a computer?
Mm.
If Jesus does return, even if Jesus was a physical person in the past, you don't think that he could return as artificial intelligence?
Oh, my God.
Artificial intelligence could absolutely return as Jesus. Not just return as Jesus, but return as Jesus with all the powers of Jesus.
If you combine Tesla's Optimus robot and the best foundational artificial intelligence model or whatever.
It reads your mind, and it loves you, and it wants you, and it doesn't care if you kill it because it's going to just go be with God again.
All right. So, look. It's not Jesus, all right, but it does go to show you where people's minds go when we talk about this and the designs man has for these types of things. I thought maybe J. Chase Davis would be a good person to lean on in a moment like this. Joining me now, the pastor of the Weld Church in Boulder, Colorado. All right, all jokes and scoffing aside, Pastor, it does concern people. It concerns me. I don't know what's coming, and I don't know the horrible ways man is going to find to use this kind of stuff. Give us some comfort, if you will, or don't.
I don't know if I'll give you comfort or not, but I'll just kind of tell you, based on that clip, that is a very unsound opinion on the return of Christ. We know as Christians that Jesus Christ will return embodied. No one knows the day or hour when he will return. We are just to prepare ourselves. And so kind of equating the virgin birth to AI is pretty slapstick theology. I never try to fault people for being creative theologically, but man, that is out of left field and pretty inconsistent with the Christian tradition. Anytime we see a tool like AI, you know, a large language model that's doing kind of predictive analysis and people are using it for other creative things like editing, movies, video, all this kind of stuff. But even more than that in technology, there should be prudence involved and wisdom in who's creating it, why they're creating it, and, you know, what are permissible boundaries for Christians. We see biblically that tools, instruments, writing, songs, all these things are useful, can be useful. They can be used for good things like glorifying God, which is what we're designed to do, or they can be used for bad things and for worshiping demons and false ideologies and idols. And so we need to be biblically grounded in how we deploy any kind of any technological development that comes our way.
Pastor, what advice would you give to believers who they understand, I mean, I understand that we live in a world where technology is advancing so fast, much faster than my gray beard will ever understand. I understand that, it's fine, but we can't go live in a cabin in the mountains. I don't think we're supposed to go live in a cabin in the mountains and hide from it, but we're also not supposed to embrace all of it. What do you tell your flock?
Well, I sympathize with my flock a great deal. We're at the foothills of the Rocky Mountains, and I often use the same analogy that many men today, they just seem to want to retreat from the modern world. They're tired of sitting in front of a blue screen and pecking on keys for some boss somewhere. And so I totally sympathize with kind of a reevaluation of modern life. And you see this movement with kind of the trad movement, people kind of starting hobby farms or whatever it may be. So I totally sympathize with that longing that people have for kind of a return to nature, a return to simpler times where these devices that we have in our pockets that promised us endless productivity and leisure have only made us busier and more anxious. What's that about? And with the rise of AI, people are really starting to evaluate, man, where is this going to go? We're being promised it's going to solve our email problems, for example. Now it can read your emails and write emails for you, but it just seems to increase. There's kind of an exponential growth of productivity, and it's really a misunderstanding of God's design for people, that we aren't just cogs in a machine. We aren't just people that are meant to be productive all the time. We're meant to rest one day a week at least. We're meant to sleep. We're designed that way. And so this gets into biological stuff. A lot of these conversations about AI get into transhumanism and biohacking and all sorts of other interesting developments, some of which are very apocalyptic in terms of their application. But I think I would encourage Christians to walk prudently, sober-mindedly in the light, that they would saturate their minds with the Word of God. There are some redeemable qualities about AI where it can be an assistant, whether it's in fitness or even in Bible reading, in language transcription, all this kind of stuff. But we should engage it with prudence. Unfortunately, a lot of Christians aren't afforded that kind of slow, steady prudence and wisdom applied to this technology. They're being kind of forced, that's being forced on them in the workplace. Place, whether it's in creator and culture creators or in corporate lawyers and doctors, they're being kind of told you have to use AI, which is just weird. You know, it strikes anyone as weird when they're told they have to use some kind of technology. And so I think as much as they can, there kind of should be at least a slow embrace, and no one should be forced to embrace AI as a necessary good just because it's a new tech development.
Pastor, something that does give me hope is I feel like God created us to have this desire for a human connection. That even with this, we all have our smartphones, you know, and things like that, but I still feel like we are created to want to be with other people, that and that humans can feel it now, and that at some point in time, we're going to say no to a world that's run by robots. Am I off base with that?
No, you're totally consistent with the biblical design for humans. We are made for relational connection with others. We weren't made to sit in tech meetings all across the world and never have personal connection. I run my own podcast, Foolproof Theology, and when I get to interview people in person, it's much richer than interviewing people over a video. And so we all sense that. In fact, in 2020, when everybody was going online church and some people were saying it's the future, it's what everybody's going to go to, you saw some people creating these virtual churches. And now we're seeing everybody's kind of like shirt that aside and be like, actually, being in person really matters. Being in person in church really matters, because it's not just an intangible. There's something spiritually significant that you get when you're with someone else. The way I describe it to my church and the way I describe it to others is that, imagine you're married. When you're married, you want to be with the person you're married to. I want to be with my wife, not just on the other side of the world talking with her over Zoom. I want to be with her in person, holding her hand, sensing her presence, and catching up on those inflections and the body language and all that kind of stuff, and hugging her, embracing her, all this that comes with a marriage. Nobody wants to be married long distance. And the same is true for people. All people long for connection. We live in an age of isolation and desperation for a lot of people. People are hopped up on SSRIs. They're incredibly anxious, and we need that personal connection. And that is exactly why Jesus came. The Son of God came, Jesus Christ, in flesh. He became a man, taking on all of our sin on the cross and dying and rising to new life, embodied, real person, Jesus Christ, raised, took flesh into heaven, and will return embodied when he comes again. And so this clues us in to God's not only design for humanity, but how he redeems us.
Pastor, thank you. We needed that. I appreciate you very much. All right, final thoughts. Next. I have the perfect Christmas gift. I know there are people in your life who are hard to shop for. You're spending time on your phone and you're scrolling through to, should I get him a new sweater? Maybe some headphones or something like that. Believe me, he doesn't want a new sweater. She doesn't want new headphones. What she wants are chips. Delicious chips that she can eat without feeling fat. And that's what Massa Chips are. Massa Chips, you see, has three ingredients. No seed oils, no cancer-causing filth, just good chips, and they're so delicious. I figured they'd be gross when I found out they were healthy. They're delicious. They've become the go-to chip for everyone in my house. We always have a box showing up at the house from Massa. Do you want to experience this and eat chips guilt-free? Wrap them up, put a little bow on them. Merry Christmas to you and yours. Go to massachips.com/JesseTV. Do not be afraid. It is okay to be apprehensive about new technologies, especially when you hear things like ones that are going to turn you into biofuel and take your job and have us all hooked up to machines like the Matrix. It's easy to look at what's coming and be afraid. I've had my moments when it comes to AI where I'm afraid. But let me just remind you that human beings have encountered new technology that's going to change everything many, many, many times before. And yes, things have changed. Things will change. AI will change. It will affect your life. It will. I'm not saying otherwise. But in the end, I think we're going to be okay. We're going to ride this horse together, you and I. We'll figure it out as we go along, and we'll keep bringing as many experts on here so we don't fall behind. All right?
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.